On a windy afternoon in the Rocky Mountains, this is Go West Young Podcast, your show about the outdoors and America's public lands. I'm Aaron Weiss at the Center for Western Priorities in Denver. On the show this week, sportswomen determined to change the face of conservation. Maybe your attitudes about hunting as well. We'll talk to Jessie Johnson from a new advocacy group, Artemis, about her work and how she became a hunter. Plus, how two deaths in New York set the stage for America's conservation legacy this week in Western history. But first, let's talk about the news. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke took one tiny step forward and two giant steps backwards on our public lands. Last Friday, Zinke promised a, quote, major conservation announcement. Consider us underwhelmed. It was an order to improve migration corridors for big game on federal land. Now, that is a good thing. It's such a good idea that something similar was part of the Obama-era Planning 2.0 rule that Zinke had urged Congress to kill last year. But at the end of the day, any good that will come from that wildlife announcement is minuscule compared to the damage that Secretary Zinke set out to inflict just 3 days later. On Monday, the White House unveiled its proposed budget. It's ugly for our parks and public lands. A proposed 16% cut at the Interior Department overall. It would cut more than 2,000 jobs at the National Park Service alone, at a time when our parks are seeing record visitation and in some cases being overwhelmed by tourists. And Zinke wants to eviscerate the Land and Water Conservation Fund, or LWCF. That's the fund that helps make our parks and monuments whole by buying up inholdings from willing sellers. The story there, basically, many of our parks are Swiss cheese. There are holes of privately owned land inside them, and there's nothing that stops landowners from building trophy homes inside park boundaries. We've seen this happen already at Zion and Black Canyon of the Gunnison. And LWCF is the only way that the Park Service has to make our parks whole. Secretary Zinke just proposed killing that entire acquisition program. He wants to cut almost all of the stateside program that's helped communities with conservation projects and local and state parks all across the country. So this budget proposal isn't about face for the secretary. Last year, Colorado Senator Cory Gardner asked him specifically about LWCF.
Would you reiterate your commitment to me that you will work with Congress to make LWCF permanent?
You have my full commitment, and all three of the Montana delegation voted in favor of it. It's an important program, especially in the West, and in Montana, it's particularly important in public access. The checkered board system out West has made it difficult sometimes to transit between Forest Service and BLM. And you need a bridge to go between the two, and the LWCF has been important in doing that. So I would support that.
So, either Zinke was flat out lying then, or he's had a sudden change of heart because now he wants to cut 98% of the Land and Water Conservation Fund, and we're not done. Alongside the budget, the White House also released its framework for an infrastructure bill, and that plan explicitly calls for selling off national park units. Besides singling out two NPS units in the Washington, D.C. area, the infrastructure plan wants to give departments the authority to sell off other federal assets as long as it makes money for the government. So for all of Zinke's claims of not wanting to sell off public lands, his boss just put it in writing. But wait, as they say, there is more. The budget and the infrastructure bill was only the start of what Zinke tried to do to our public lands on Monday, because after that, he followed it up with an announcement about methane. So Interior is getting rid of the Bureau of Land Management's methane waste rule. That's a rule that required oil and gas companies operating on public land to capture methane that escaped from drilling operations before they could just vent or burn it off. Methane, by the way, it is a problem that's bad enough satellites can see a methane cloud sitting over the Four Corners region. You can look at aerial pictures at night from North Dakota, and the state gets lit up like a major city, but from methane flares, not city lights. And methane, of course, is an incredibly bad greenhouse gas. It warms the planet way more, like orders of magnitude more than carbon dioxide, for several years after it's released. And don't forget, we're talking about a publicly owned natural resource here. You own the methane coming off public lands, and if companies are going to waste it, it only makes sense for them to pay you for it. That was the whole point of the methane rule. So, what should we make of all this awful stuff that gets crammed into just one day? My takeaway here, keep your eye on the ball. The budget proposal, as awful as it is DOA. Congress is already doing its own thing on a spending bill. It's going to last 2 years, looks like. If Congress suddenly starts cutting 2,000 park rangers, light up those phones, but it seems like that's unlikely right now. And the infrastructure proposal is just that. It's a proposal, and Congress would have to take action to make land sell-offs possible. And now that we know Secretary Zinke's true intentions there, we can and will be on the lookout for any bad bills that might let him sell off parks down the road. But giving oil and gas companies the green light to spew more methane into the atmosphere, that's a real thing that Ryan Zinke can do on his own right now. You're going to see a rulemaking process and a public comment period around it. I will definitely let you know when that opens up, but sadly, if there's one thing that we've learned over the last year, it's that public comments make no difference to Ryan Zinke unless you're an oil, gas, or coal, or uranium company. But it's still important to get your thoughts on the record. It's easy to get discouraged after a day like we just saw on this Monday. And speaking up is the best way for Secretary Zinke to know that we won't get complacent. We won't let anything like this slide, even if they try to bury the announcement on Budget Day. And yeah, it's kind of cathartic, too, just like this podcast is for me. Our guest this week is a rising star in the conservation world, an accomplished bow hunter and public lands advocate, Jesse Johnson. Is one of the founding members of Artemis, a sportswomen's coalition that formed in 2017. She also works for the Wyoming Wildlife Federation and has volunteered with Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Jesse joins us on the line from Cheyenne, Wyoming, and thank you so much for taking the time today, Jesse.
Oh, absolutely. I'm excited to be on.
So before we get into Artemis, give us a sense of your background. How did you get into hunting?
Well, I am a relatively new hunter in the standards, I guess, of what the West would call it. I did not grow up hunting. I did grow up with a father who hunted. Both my parents are ranch managers, so we always had this access to these great open spaces, both private and public. But I didn't pick up a bow until I moved to Wyoming and met a wonderful person who sat down and took the time to teach me how to bow hunt. And I will never look back. It is absolutely how I get into the landscape, how I find a sense of my place in the world, and it leaves me refreshed and ready to get back up and fight for protecting it.
So bow hunting, obviously, that's a whole different can of worms than grabbing a rifle and heading out into the woods. You have to be pretty darn sure of yourself. I mean, this is something that takes a whole lot of practice, right?
Absolutely. I purchased a bow and didn't even take it hunting for about the first year and a half of owning it. I didn't feel comfortable the first season around, just didn't feel like I was quite ready. And, you know, even in shooting daily, you have to set your own parameters as a bow hunter. You know, there's no rule book that says you can't shoot past this yardage, but an ethical bow hunter will put parameters on themselves and know where their shots are good and know when it's out of their ability. And I just, that first year, didn't feel like I knew myself nor my ability well enough to call that ethical. So I waited a while and I practiced daily with it and consistently, you know, it's always a learning adventure with a bow. And so, yeah, it takes dedication. It is more of a lifestyle than just a hobby.
So then walk us through the first hunt when you decided you were ready. How did that go your first time out?
It was unbelievable. The first, what I would say is I take the month of September off. That is archery season here in Wyoming. And, I just sort of made it my life plan to make sure that I wasn't working those days because that's really how you recharge and how you get into a place. And, as a bow hunter, you need that time. And so the first couple, what I would say hunts, which was the first 3 days of September, were just a lot of learning and a lot of being on my stomach in sagebrush and like watching deer run away from me because they're a lot, you know, better at they're
always going to be faster than you are.
Yes, exactly. And they're also a lot more alert, and I'm a lot louder than a deer. So that was, you know, learning kind of how that went. And I was lucky to have this mentor along with me, who was a wonderful teacher in that, and just kind of like cautioned on patience. And, you know, as a bow hunter, like, you'll hear this. Anybody that's getting into it is like, oh, you're not going to get anything your first year. Like, just expect to go out and learn how smart animals are and how loud you actually are. And so I went out with these, you know, low expectations and just wanting to learn and just be out in this incredible sagebrush country and watch these animals that I'm just in awe of. And I guess to like back up a little bit, I spend my year watching deer. It's something, it's an odd pastime, I guess you could call it. But the deer that I was hunting that year, a deer that I'd known for almost a year now and had seen earlier in the year, and knew a lot of their feeding habits, knew where they were, and you know, had an idea. Mule deer have a high fidelity to their home range, so had a great idea of like where they would be and what times. And finally, I spent about 2.5 to 3 hours on my stomach, sort of army crawling and pushing my bow slowly ahead of me to get in on this group of bucks. And one buck in particular that I had seen earlier that year, and I can't explain it. Like, I looked at that buck and I looked at Jared, who's the person who taught me how to shoot a bow and basically how to hunt. And I looked at him and I said, I want that deer. Like, he's beautiful. He's healthy. He's been in this incredible landscape. And Jared goes, you know, don't get cocky. This is your first bow season. And I said, okay, you know, I want an ethical hunt, and I'll be happy with that. But I'm pushing my bow ahead of me, you know, come about middle of the first week of September. And, remember sticking my elbow in a cactus and kind of like having this moment of like, oh my God, what am I doing? And then kept going forward and got into a position where I kind of had a higher sagebrush next to me. And I remember these three or four bucks, you know, it was a little one and there was a pretty big one. And then there was what I like to say is my buck that I was sort of in the center of it. And I kept telling myself, like, whatever deer gets within an ethical range, like, you can't be picky. This is your first time. Like, you know, make sure it's a good shot. That's what counts. So I kept telling myself that. And they just stayed right at 30 yards, which is kind of what I told myself was like, I wasn't going to shoot past that. And they stayed right around the 31 to 32 yards. These deer, they know. And they kind of, they didn't ever act like they knew where I was. I definitely knew that they had at least a little bit of my scent. And they turned and they stayed at that 32 to 35 yard mark and kind of went down the hill. And I was like, oh, well, like that was close, but it was really cool to watch. And then they turned around and they came back and they stopped. And this is probably 3 hours in. And, it was getting to like lower light and it was sort of the last of shooting light is what I would call it. And, these three deer came and the only one that stopped within my, yardage that I'd marked for myself was the buck that 3 months earlier I'd looked at Jared and said, I want that one. And, I have no idea what kind of serendipitous event created this opportunity and this connection, but, I had that moment where I was like, well, I guess now I need to draw my bow, because he was standing broadside. He was at about 26 yards and it was beautiful. The Wind River Mountains were behind him. I'd watched them feed in the sagebrush and had this just sort of like pink glow that was touching the tops of the sagebrush. And I remember like time just slowing down and pulling my bow back and just sort of having that moment of like, well, I guess now I let the arrow loose, because you know, shooting at a live animal is very, very different than shooting at a target. And I remember watching the arrow fly, and animals have a tendency to do what we call jumping the string, which is the twang of the bowstring sometimes can spook them. And so they kind of hunch up and they'll like go to run. And the bizarre thing was, is that the two deer that were with him ran and he didn't. He just stayed. Wow. And looked at me. And I will never forget, because we made eye contact as my arrow contacted him, and it was a perfect shot placement. I remember seeing the arrow sort of go right where I wanted it to. And then he turned and just sort of went down the hill. And, you know, with archery, we make it this rule that after you make a shot, you do not move for the next 30 minutes. And you do that so you don't spook the animal. And the last thing you want to do, even if you make a bad shot, if you make a bad shot, you have a wounded animal. And the last thing you want to do is spook them so they run further. And so you wait. And I remember waiting those 30 minutes and just like shaking. And it was like this mixture of like sort of horror and excitement all at once. And just wanting to make sure that like I felt really great about that shot. And by that time, after the half hour had passed, it was like actually getting dark. And so I waited a little bit longer just because I wanted to be sure, and stood up. And Jared had been down off the hill from me, and he came up to he'd heard the thwack of the arrow, and he was like, "Oh my God, she got something." And he came up and was like, "What happened?" And I walked him through what had happened. And so we went down and where I shot it, and there was good blood sign. And by that time it was pitch black and it started snowing. And, which is not great when you are looking for an animal. And we spent the next whole night looking for this deer, but couldn't find him. And I was just like beside myself and horrified at what I'd done. And I was so new at it that like, while I was very confident in my shot, I was also not confident in my confidence. And we came back the next morning, same place at like first light, and put a spotting scope up and found him immediately. And I will never forget, because Jared was the one that glassed him up initially. And he like turns to me, he's like, "You got to look through this spotting scope." And I was like, "Oh no, like I'm going to see like an injured deer, like walking around like with this horrific wound, and this is awful." And I looked in, and he hadn't gone 50 yards and died. So he died 50 yards from where I shot him. I just couldn't find him. He had tucked his head into a sagebrush a bit, so he had no eye shine. And it was dark by that time, and we were walking around, and honestly, our footprints were within a couple of feet of him, but he looked like a rock. So we just didn't find him that evening. So everything, you know, he died probably in the first 2 minutes from when my arrow hit him, and it was a perfect shot placement. I couldn't have wished or asked for better. And that relief in knowing that it was a quick death, and it was a, you know, painless in that sense. And, that almost 2 years of preparation and this incredible connection to this animal and this landscape kind of came to fruition in this moment. And I quite had that celebratory mode. I think I immediately went to this just like overwhelmed gratitude. And even now I get like a little choked up around it, because it really introduced me into this world of being so thankful for the things and the opportunities that we have, but thankful to the animal for that. And, recognizing that, you know, this leads into like what I do now, is that instance, that hunt is really what kicked me into gear to spend my life working for these animals' wild places that they depend on, and being a voice for those that don't have it.
So then how does that inform what you do now? And walk us through some of what you do both with Artemis and Wyoming Wildlife Federation.
Absolutely. So with Artemis, you know, I'm sort of the coordinator with Artemis. I'm currently the only paid staff for Artemis. However, I would like to plug that we are hiring a program manager, and that job opportunity is going to be open for the next couple weeks.
Send your resumes now.
But yeah, send your resumes now. We're looking for some awesome people to join us. But with Artemis, I do a lot of work just sort of, it's been in the creation of it, honestly. It's been everything from coming up with the name and the logo to helping get the awesome 10 co-founders that we have together to help dictate mission and voice and everything around that. And Artemis is a women's specific hunting and angling coalition, but it is also, and I think the most important part, it's an initiative that's born out of the National Wildlife Federation. So the National Wildlife Federation, finally, you know, they, like so many large organizations, talk about all of this, like, let's be inclusive to women, let's be diverse, let's do this. And I finally, NWF put their money where their mouth was and said, all right, like, let's create a place for this. And Artemis is what came of that. And then with Wyoming Wildlife Federation, I am their public lands coordinator. So everything public land wise, in the state of Wyoming, that's under my jurisdiction as far as like what I cover for the Federation. And, currently I'm actually down, in Cheyenne, the state capital, at their legislative session. I've been working and doing some lobby work around that. But as far as what you said of how that informs what I do, I think really it was the gratitude and the realization that, this is absolutely how, like, what I want to spend my life doing, came from that moment on the hill, sitting with that deer's head in my lap, kind of having this mixture of melancholy and, elation and joy at being able to have experienced being part of a food chain and the kind of work that goes into that, and having a little bit of sympathy for the animals that, have to exist in that food chain, continually, and really understanding the kind of, hard work it takes to live there, and that we as humanity are only making it harder.
So you're at the Capitol this week. What sorts of issues are you working on during this legislative session?
Oh boy. Well, there's about, I have a spreadsheet of about 19 different bills that are concerning to wildlife or hunters or anglers. And they, I mean, they range from anything from legalizing the hunting color pink to worrying about a sort of stealthy federal land transfer bill. So there's everything from sort of like the inane to the really concerning that comes there. I think a big push, especially for Wyoming Wildlife Federation, I mean, you know, public lands and public hands being a big, big issue here and something we very much support, but also funding for the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, because they continually come under fire from our state legislature and they just get their budget picked away at, and they are who manage our wildlife, and that's what we support.
You've sat down already with U.S. senators and representatives to talk about your work with Artemis. What have those meetings been like for you?
They've been very, actually pretty wonderful and sort of eye-opening. You know, we are, a lot of the Artemis co-founders, myself included, are very new at sort of the, what I would call the legislative game. But I am lucky that when I have sat down with Wyoming's delegations, they have been very welcoming, and Wyoming is unique in that sense because we are a smaller state, and you know, it's easy to go track down your two senators and one congressman. I have not sat down with Wyoming's congressman, Liz Cheney. I've never had an opportunity to talk with her. We did make have a meeting set up, but she was unable to make it to it. I think she had another vote that came up, but with Wyoming Wildlife Federation, we've actually worked a lot with Senator Barrasso's staff, and have found them very easy to contact and very easy to work with. We do not always agree. I definitely recognize that, but I do feel like it's been a very good meeting that we've had with that. I have been in others from other states that have been a little more, what I would say, a relationship that's been a little more tenacious or tenuous line, but they've never been off color, I guess is the word I would use. Like, I never felt like I was treated differently because I was a woman. But I have realized that having women present in the room, especially female hunters and anglers, changes the tone of the conversation. And I've been really surprised by that.
I wanted to ask about that. I mean, you mentioned the pink bill that would legalize pink as a hunting color. Obviously, the sportsman's world is very male-dominated, I mean, including the word sportsmen, and Artemis uses sportswomen. What kind of response have you gotten from starting a sports women's group?
I guess the quote I would use is, it's been a lot like drinking from a fire hose. when Artemis rolled out, we had almost more interest than we knew what to do with. I think women, especially hunting and angling women, have been needing a platform for that voice. Sportsmen groups, clearly, market to men first. You know, it's often a very sort of like dudes around a beer, like, you know, dudes having beer sitting around a campfire kind of thing. And it's not always a friendly environment, or maybe not friendly, but it's not always a comfortable environment as a woman to walk into and try and fit into. And so Artemis came into existence, I think, surely to be that platform and to help facilitate women that were out there to become leaders in and of their own right. And to step up and start being a voice in the ways that we know that they can be, have had they a place to do it. The tone that women take, and this is actually a phrase I'm going to steal from a friend of mine over at National Wildlife Federation, is that women have a more emotionally intelligent way of speaking about hunting and angling. And it's a lot harder to write us off as these sort of machismo, testosterone-ridden killers if it's a couple of women sitting down in front of you talking about hunting and the wildlife and the fisheries that we are all reliant for our way of life on.
You mentioned right at the beginning the importance to you of an ethical hunt, of knowing what your range is, of not taking that shot any further than 30 yards because you know that's what your capabilities are. What is to you an ethical hunt?
You know, I think that's such a gray area. It's so hard because it is personal. But for me, and this is personally my opinion, an ethical hunt is one where you have matched wits with an animal and you are in their wheelhouse, so to speak. So you're in an area where they have the ability to detect you. You know, which is why with bow hunting, I like it so much just because you have to get close. And I think having that sort of matched wits, that one-on-one, I don't know how to phrase that so much. But something that results in a fair chance at this animal, but also gives the animal a fair chance to get away from you. And a lot of that goes into, you know, I'm never going to be one that uses a sight on my bow that has a laser on it. And, you know, limiting myself to the technology I use and stick with this still sort of muscle powered technology with the bow is something that I really like. That just fits with who I am. And then I think a big part of that is knowing where you hunt and what you hunt. Like I said, I've followed mule deer. There's a couple I know have known for the last 4 years now, and spend my time scouting and knowing where I'm going and knowing where these deer are and knowing how the elk move in an area. And that's been a big part of who I am as a hunter and how I became okay and an advocate for hunting.
So we are kind of hard on Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke on this podcast, and not just because he wears his cowboy hat backwards and can't seem to rig a fly rod correctly, according to Outside Magazine. So if you had the chance to sit down with him, either in his office or around a campfire after a hunting trip, what would you say to him in his role and what you've seen him do as Interior Secretary?
I guess I would like to ask him who he thinks his public land users are. You know, he continually states himself sort of as a Teddy Roosevelt conservationist. And I would just love to hear him talk about who his public land customers are, who he supports as Secretary of the Interior. And then, just who he is and what he said, I expect that he would talk a lot about permit holders and Western states and, you know, probably a lot of the more industry style things. And I think the ability to maybe sternly remind him that public lands are held in trust for all Americans, not just me, the hunter in the West, but maybe the cat lady in New York too. And I think he forgets that the multiple use, as is defined in their Federal Land Policy and Management Act, goes into things that are a lot more than the extractive industries.
So you've mentioned your hiring. You've talked about drinking from the fire hose. Obviously, you are off to an incredible start for a group that just started up last year. What's next for you and for Artemis?
Well, I mean, I think the big thing is the hiring thing. Once we get another program manager on, we can really go off and running. But I do know that we have a couple, what I would say is maybe dreams that we're working to see come to fruition right now. And some of that is creating a leadership academy in Senses for women of hunting and angling and the conservation minded that want to learn more about whether it's public land policy or wildlife policy or how to engage or advocacy, and having an ability to have these sort of couple classes held throughout the states for a couple months. And then, giving people that want to take a leadership in these issues, whether it's going into the agencies themselves or it's working in conservation work and NGO work, that we can give them tools for that leadership. And I know we're kicking this off with a couple little clinics that we're holding around the western states. One of our co-founders, Alexis, is out of Billings, and she's just a whiz with this kind of thing. And she'll be holding those clinics around, I think, both Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico. Don't quote me on that one. There might be more added or there may be less. But that's one. And then I think another one is that as, you know, Artemis came into existence, we sort of designated our three pillars. You know, what is important to us? And, you know, a big one is public land. So that is always going to be something where, protecting, preserving, and working to continue for the future generations. And, you know, clearly, as you stated earlier, Ryan Zinke, Secretary Ryan Zinke, has been rough on those. We've done a big monuments push. We took a lot of our co-founders hunting in different monuments and did some videos around it to talk about how monuments protect land, but they also protect opportunity. And then I think another one is we looked at iconic species. We narrowed it down to the mule deer and the cutthroat trout for now, understanding that those are some very beginning, often like a new hunter, like myself, that's the first thing you take in the West could be a mule deer or a beginning fisherman, you know, and both of those species need help. So with the mule deer, we're looking at a lot of the migration work that has happened around in these western states and figuring out that the connectivity of landscapes is an incredibly important aspect to wildlife management, and understanding that we can't just look at certain places and manage for animals in certain places. We have to manage them on the whole of the landscape that they use, which is, I mean, in Wyoming, in that case, it's a 150 to 170 mile stretch of land. So understand that we have to start looking big picture as far as wildlife management. And then that last one is recruitment. And that's recruitment of women who are already hunting and fishing into the conservation world to start being voices and not, you know, just sort of being the background voice, but also recruiting women who want to take into leadership positions, recruiting women who maybe have been interested in hunting and fishing, but have never had the opportunity or maybe never had anybody take them. You know, sometimes I think it's a lot easier to get into something if you have a mentor or if you just have a friend that's willing to learn with you. And so those three big things are things we'll be continually pushing. I know a lot of us will be headed to a Women in Conservation Leadership Summit that's held in Maryland that the National Wildlife Federation's put on. And we'll be headed there in March. And I hope a lot more sort of forward movement comes out of that. But we're continually changing, and we are new. We're a year old. So things come down pretty quick, and we still have the agility to change and respond to it and sort of forge our way into our future.
That's a whole lot on your plate for a brand new group. Last question then. If you could, what's your dream hunting trip? If you could head anywhere, where do you want to go next?
Oh boy. I don't know if I have one.
Or two or three or four.
I'm very excited. I've been planning it's a coos deer hunt in Arizona. And it's this, a coos deer is a subspecies of whitetail, and it's this sort of high desert gray ghost is what they call them. And the country they live in is unbelievable. It's some of these sky islands that are in Arizona. So surrounded by these flatlands, and there are these mountains that come up and are sort of these, have a little higher precipitation and a little bit more water. And it's incredibly rugged country, but places that are like that, that I want to go see. And it's funny, you know, I was asked this earlier actually by a representative from Wyoming. He was like, well, as a young person, like, how do you choose where you travel? And I was like, it's the amount of public land and the access to it. And he was floored by that. But then also, it's what, and this sounds, this is a weird motivation, but what I can hunt there. So hunting gets you into a landscape more than just hiking or backpacking, because you tend to go off trail because there's no written place about where an animal will go. You go where the animals go. And so places like these remote spots in Arizona. And I mean, I think if I had to pick a place, top of my list is probably Alaska. And if I'm really picky and if I win the lottery, it'd be a dull sheep in Alaska. But it's because of the country those incredible animals live in. And honest to God, if I went and spent 12 days hunting my butt off and didn't get one, I would still think that I had just experienced the most incredible hunt of my life.
It's amazing. Jesse Johnson is the Artemis Sportswomen's coordinator. Jesse, thank you so much for taking the time and joining the podcast, and best of luck to you and Artemis in your rapid growth phase that it looks like you're about to enter here.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really honored to be on this podcast, and look forward to seeing you guys in the future too.
Hey, one quick note. Right after we wrapped up that interview, Jesse got word that that bad land transfer bill that she was worried about in Wyoming, it died before it even got introduced. And that goes to show what happens when you speak up for public lands. We always wrap up with a look back at this week in Western history. Only this week, our story starts in New York City. It was February 14th, 1884, when Teddy Roosevelt's wife and mother both died, hours apart. Roosevelt was a 25-year-old state legislator working in Albany on a government reform bill. His wife, Alice Lee, had just given birth to a daughter, Alice, 2 days prior. Teddy was summoned home from the Capitol to find his mother, Mitty, dead from typhoid fever, and his wife, semi-comatose, dying from kidney failure. She succumbed the next afternoon in Teddy's arms. He wrote in his diary that day a large X and just one sentence: "The light has gone out of my life." Distraught, Teddy left Alice in the care of his sister, and he traveled to a ranch in the Dakota Territory that he'd invested in the previous year. Even though the Dakotas were in the middle of nowhere, he found that ranch to be, believe it or not, too busy and crowded. It was on a common route out of the town of Medora, so Teddy established a second ranch to the north called Elkhorn, and he started work on what would become his home there. Elkhorn turned into the staging point for his hunting trips. He'd go on to write 3 books about his ranching and hunting experiences. That first book was prophetic. He could see already that the cattle industry in the Dakotas was unsustainable. With too many cattle and no regulation, the land was quickly overgrazed. The ranch turned out to be a financial disaster for him. The winter of 1886 and 87 killed tens of thousands of cattle across the Dakota Territory. Roosevelt lost over half his herd. He eventually got out of the ranching business, but his experience in the Badlands laid the groundwork for the Roosevelt conservation ethic that we look to today. If he hadn't gone to the Dakotas, he wouldn't have discovered the cowboy life or gone on to form the Rough Riders, which made him a national celebrity during the Spanish-American War and propelled Teddy Roosevelt to the presidency. Today, Elkhorn Ranch has been preserved as Theodore Roosevelt National Park. You can go there and see the landscape as Roosevelt saw it when he went there to escape a family tragedy this week in 1884. That's it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. We love getting your feedback and hearing from listeners. Podcast at westernpriorities.org is where to send your ideas for new guests down the road. And please, if you haven't yet, go leave us a review on iTunes. That's the best way for new listeners to find us and find what we're doing here. Also, if you enjoyed today's episode about hunting, head all the way back to episode 5 in this feed from December 2016 for a conversation with hunter and public lands advocate Randy Newberg. He also has some great stories. We've got a link to that in the show notes as well. Thanks again to our guest, Jessie Johnson from Artemis. You'll find links to her work and Artemis's videos in the show notes, of course. My name is Aaron Weiss, and on behalf of all of us at the Center for Western Priorities, thanks for listening.